Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Letitia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted. This is your trigger warning. This podcast contains unfiltered conversations about trauma, abuse, and survival. Discretion is advised. This is not therapy or medical advice, just real people sharing real stories. So please take care of yourself and pause if you need to. If this conversation hits home, grab the book Survival Mode Exit Plan, your raw, unapologetic blueprint to break free. Available now by scanning the QR code or clicking the link in the comments. Hello, 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 and welcome back to Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Letitia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and I am super excited about this episode today. I have a guest today named Aria. So Aria, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, thank you for having me. First of all, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with me. Again, my name is Aria. I am from New York. I am a fifth generation New Yorker. My family's been in New York City for over 125 years, so we are one of the originals. I'm an international portrait photographer, so I do something called destination portraits, where I travel to different parts of the world seasonally and photograph people's honeymoons, vacations, and solo travelers on different excursions. So I have a bit of an adventurous lifestyle, but I'm here to share my story of my childhood and some things that happened as an adult. When I was a kid, I grew up in New York. My parents were married and got divorced when I was five. So I was in kindergarten. And we suddenly moved away from New York. My mother got divorced and moved another man into our apartment, which we all thought was very strange because it happened very quickly, within a few months. And then a few months later, we were told we were moving to South Carolina. And that was the last time I saw my father. Never saw him again. We were told that our father wanted nothing to do with us, that he didn't want to be a part of the family. He doesn't want you anymore. And we moved away, and that was that. So for 10 years, I lived in South Carolina. Every time I didn't have school, I would go back to New York. So I would go back to visit my Nana during the summer. I would go for Thanksgiving. I would go for Christmas. I would go for spring break. So it was almost as if I was in boarding school in the South. And then I would go back to New York. And I would frequently ask for my father and was told the same thing. When we were in school in the South, I had a lot of students ask us why we moved so much, because I think I lived in 8 different houses between the ages of 5 and 15, and I went to 7 different schools. So sometimes we would move in the middle of a school year. Sometimes we would move one block away. Sometimes we would move the next town over. It just was very odd. And as a child, I thought we were moving because my mother was embarrassed. So my stepfather was, and my mother, but more my stepfather, was both physically and verbally abusive. And occasionally the cops would come to our house. And I thought we were moving because she was embarrassed that the neighbors knew, or that she didn't want the schools to catch on, or she didn't want the police to catch on. Because often when we would move, it would be a different police department that would come. So there was no association between the two police departments to catch on to there's something wrong going on in this household. So at the age of 15, there was a big physical altercation in our home. And I said, I have to get out of this house. I'm not going to survive if I stay here. And I've had two siblings attempt suicide, and I just older siblings, and I thought, I don't want to end up in that state, and I just want to, make something of myself. And I think the only way for me to do so is to get out of this house. So the first time I asked my mother, I was 14, she told me no. And then throughout that year, I had to think like an adult, and I had to think, okay, I have to sell this to her. In what way would it be beneficial for me not to be here? My stepfather always made a statement, if one of you weren't here, it's one less mouth to feed. So I kind of pitched it to her in that way. If I leave, it's one less person you have to worry about. You don't have to worry about school. I was kind of the black sheep in the family in the regards to I didn't conform to what my mother and stepfather were doing. I often spoke out against them. And sometimes I would speak out intentionally because the physical abuse would be taken away from my siblings and put on me. And for me, I just had a very strong pain tolerance. So if my stepfather hit me, he would almost get mad because I didn't react the way my siblings would react. So getting me out of the house, I think, was beneficial to them because my siblings were seeing how outspoken I was or how defiant I was. So she agreed as long as she can continue to declare me on her taxes. And that was the agreement, that as long as she could still maintain, the money that was coming in. Because she told the government she was abandoned with four kids and her husband left her and abandoned her and she got remarried. And that was the story that every neighbor was told and everybody believed this story. So I left when I was 15 and moved back to New York. I moved in with my great aunt. And 2 years later, I went to college in New York City. So I went to FIT, which is the Fashion Institute of Technology, and I went to NYU. I went on to work Fashion Week every season. I think I was 20 when I started working for Jay-Z's publicist. I was 21, 22, working for Jay-Z as an event planner. And then I got a freelance job for Versace, working as a freelance photographer, ran off to Paris at 24. At 25, went back to the States and started my own company. And when I was young, I thought if I get out of this house and I make something of myself, I could save my siblings, my younger siblings, because there was three left. And what happened during that time was my mother did what she basically made up a story like she did with my father. Oh, Aria doesn't want anything to do with you. She doesn't want to be in your life. That's why she's left. So I had to combat this, their mother telling them this is why she left, when really that's not why she left. And two of my siblings were 3 and 5 when I left. So they don't really remember what happened, and they're just going off of what my mother told them. So fast forward maybe 13 years. I am 33 on vacation in New Orleans, and I'm walking down the street. And I just finished a gym class on my vacation. And this is during a year after the pandemic. And the gym instructor tells me where I can go get a smoothie. And I said, okay, I've never been to New Orleans, don't know where I'm going, looking at the map, trying to figure out where to go. He says, oh, just go up a block and to the right. So I go up a block and to the right, but I cross the street before I make the right. When I cross the street, I see this woman who's about my height, looks very familiar. And I thought, oh, that's so strange. I'm 5'11", so 180 centimeters. People aren't walking around my size. It's just not very common. And gosh, she sure looks familiar. And I went to go to the smoothie store and it was locked, even though they were supposed to be open. So I'm knocking on the window and the guy's telling me 1 minute. And I thought, oh, it's June in New Orleans. It's so hot. I'm not going to stand out here and wait. So I'm going to go back to my Airbnb. And I pass her again and we both look at each other like, I know you, but I don't know why. So I kept turning around. I know this woman. I don't know why I know her. So I walk half a block and something in me says, Aria, go back. So I go back and I'm literally pacing She's on one side of the street. I'm on the other side of the street, and I'm pacing back and forth, trying to be discreet, which, as tall as I am, I can't be discreet. And at this point, she's looking at me, and the two men she's with are also looking at me like I probably look crazy to them, just pacing back and forth. And she goes to get in her car. And so I called a friend. I said, "Listen, there's this woman across the street. I know her. I don't know why." And my friend said, "You've never been to New Orleans. You don't know anybody there." And I said, "Yeah, but my dad is from here, but I don't know. Maybe she's just go ask her. Like, it's the South. People are friendly. You can just go ask." So she's already in her car. So the two men who were on the sidewalk, they said, "Excuse me, is that woman's last name Smith by chance? Is my last name Smith?" And they said, "Yeah, why?" And I said, "Is she related to a Jerome Smith, who's my father?" And they both look at me and they say, "Why?" And I said, "Oh, because I'm Jerome's daughter." And they both just got very silent. And I said, "Is she related to Jerome?" And they said, "Yeah, that's her sister. Or you must be one of the missing girls." And I thought, "What?" And I, in that moment, everything clicked. I realized, the hopping around to different schools, not being, I mean, even in terms of our grandfather was in our life when we were young, that was over. Everybody just suddenly disappearing. It wasn't because they didn't want to be around, it was because she took us. And my mother is a very spiteful person. She's also a very greedy person. And she didn't get what she wanted. So, in terms of money, in terms of my father's family financing her, my grandfather was a freedom rider and worked with Martin Luther King. My uncle was in the NBA. My dad was a designer for Henri Bendel and then had his own line in Bloomingdale's. He designed pieces for Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson. And my mother did nothing. She has accomplished nothing. And so during their life, she wanted more. And my father's family, they all worked for what they had. And you need to work for what you have too. And my mother's an only child, extremely spoiled. I partially blame, her, the people who raised her. But oh, I was shocked. I was shocked, but I wasn't. And so she got out of the car. Nobody even said anything to her. And they're just telling her, like, you have to come back, come back. So she gets out of the car and I just start crying on the sidewalk. And the first thing she said to me was, "The last time I saw you were in diapers." And I just, it was very shocking to say the least. And in that moment on the sidewalk, we're all piecing together the puzzles, like, yeah, you went missing around this time, and how my grandfather went to New York. Mind you, this was like 1992. My father was in his late 20s, going to the police and saying, my ex is gone with my kids, especially as a black man in the early 90s. Oh, it's just a domestic dispute. You'll figure it out. She'll come back. Here's a phone number for, domestic disputes. It was different back then. And now taking a child across state lines without the parents' consent is a felony. It's felony kidnapping. Even if you're married, it's still considered kidnapping. So the crazy part was that my dad's sister, my aunt, asked me why, what brought you to New Orleans? And I said, "Oh, I'm on my way to California. My house in California isn't ready. So I just chose New Orleans because during the lockdown, all the southern states were pretty open. And I had bought a ticket to see an artist, to go to his gallery the next day, this guy named B. Mike." And she said, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yeah, why?" And she said, "Tomorrow that artist is revealing a mural of your grandfather." So either way, it would have bumped into them in some way, shape, or form, which is crazy to think about. And so my mother's aware that I know, and she, no contact from anybody. My mother, my siblings still, have nothing to say about it. And I, a month later, retrace my steps for those 30 years. I contacted every school I went to, every doctor's office I went to, and found that my mother had wiped our records. So it was as if we didn't exist. So what my mother would do is contact my father's family and say, "I'll let you see them, but you need to send me a check because, I'm all alone." And so they would say, "Okay," just to get the address. And then when she got the money, she would run. So that's why we would move in like the randomly in the middle of a school year, or we would move. Well, I remember once we literally moved one block away. So it was like she just had to get a new address to get away in case they found her. And my grandfather told me when I saw him for the first time. I remember my grandfather very well. And when I saw him for the first time 30 years later, he said, you know, at one point I had to stop because she was just extorting us for money. And I had to accept that you were gone. And, you know, so I didn't blame my father's family at all. And I also learned from a family member on my mother's side, my grandmother's sister who passed away in 2013. When she died, I was helping my grandmother go through all these papers, and I found an email from my mother. And it was a photo of a girl with another woman. And it was my stepfather's secret child that my mother had been keeping, that my mother knew existed, but again, was keeping this man from her, or keeping this child from her father. Same thing, because she wanted whatever money he has to go to me, whatever, you know, attention has to go to me. So not only have you kept us from our father for 30 years, there's another girl out there who lived relatively close, maybe 2-3 hours away from us, who you also kept from her father the past 30 plus years. So my stepfather has since then died. He died maybe a few months, maybe less than a year before I walked into my family on the sidewalk. So all of this has just happened within the past couple of years. But
have you reconnected with your father?
So that's another thing. My father tried for years to find us and just gave up on life, essentially. He didn't want anything to do with his family. He ended up homeless on the streets in New York. His brother, who was in the NBA, flew up to New York and said, all right, this is like, you have, I understand. I mean, you lost 4 children. I think anybody would be distraught if you lose 4 of your kids. They put him in a treatment center. He was there for maybe a year or two. He moved down to Atlanta to where his mother was living. And then, from what I was told, had such a level of shame that, you know, he completely let his life go. And there he was years later, that he's not in a place that he wants to see anybody, because he feels like, you know, my kids have gone on and done all these things. Look what I've done, nothing. And it infuriated me to know that this man was so talented and had so much going for himself, and she ruined him. I mean, it's not like he ran off, you know, if he didn't move on and get a new wife and have kids. He just was like, that's it. Like, his kids were everything to him. And for him to lose four of your children from age, I was 5. So my sister was 8. So age 1 to age 8 were the 4 of us. And to wake up one morning and they're just
gone.
Yeah, just gone. And she had no remorse. Not shocking, because this is how she's been, you know, forever. But yeah, I don't know if the day will come where my siblings ever come around and see her for what she is. And I don't know if the day will ever come where my father will have the strength to see me. And I also don't want to force it, because the mental state that he's in, you know, I can't imagine having lived on the street for 10, 20 years and then someone saying, oh, we found one of your kids who wants to see you. And you, of course, you're ashamed. Of course, you know, I think that's a normal feeling to think.
Yeah.
The time I saw him, he was maybe 30 years old. So now he would be about 63, which is, for me, is crazy. Because in my mind, I still see that 6'4", 30-year-old. And yeah. I think it would be shocking for the both of us. But I just, my mother. I think for me, the biggest takeaway is for people to realize that it's okay to go your own way if it's for your mental health and for your well-being. Because I can't imagine, I would not have accomplished all I've accomplished and be where I am today had I stayed in that house. And sometimes I look back and I wish I could talk to my 15-year-old self, because I think, well, damn, she's brave. The same, your mother, listen, I'm leaving. I have to get out of here. Most, and even when I, as a photographer, I do a lot of family portraits, and I will occasionally meet a 15-year-old, and I think, I mean, for a kid to say that to their mother is pretty bold to say, you know. Yeah, I have to get out.
You took radical ownership of your life, which sometimes people don't do until they're in their 50s, right?
Forever. Some adults don't have the Self-awareness. That's, I actually talked with an Uber driver once, and he said to me, "You have a very high sense of self-awareness. You're very lucky." And I thought, is it rare?
It
Is
is.
that a rare trait? And I've learned, you know, in my 38 years of living, it is. A lot of people are in bad situations, and they know that it's bad, and they stay in it. And I don't know what it within me as a 15-year-old was conscious enough to know, you got to get out of here. It's like I'm leaving my siblings behind, and my younger siblings, to this day, I love more than anything. And it really hurts me to know that we have no relationship because of my mother, which was well orchestrated by her. And I felt a lot of guilt in my 20s because I was, you know, living this high life. I was at Fashion Week, and I was at these private parties with Lenny Kravitz and Rihanna. Sometimes I'm in the room thinking, my gosh, like, how are you thinking of me? I remember one, you know, there's a rule at Fashion Week. You can never have an empty seat because it looks bad when the press takes a photo. And I remember my boss putting me in a seat to fill an empty chair. And I was sitting next to Heidi Klum and maybe Paris Hilton. I just thought, yes, me? Something. The kid who grew up in this abusive household who at 15 said, I'm getting out of here because I want more for myself. And then to be sitting in that seat to, even as an event planner for JV and doing these events and starting my own business. And I think the biggest client I had as the photographer with the King of Spain and being in a room with these royals, I thought, oh my gosh, like this is, I always knew as a kid I'd grow up and do something cool, but I didn't think I'd be this cool.
Yeah, you're pretty amazing.
But I didn't think this, no.
I want to ask, you know, because a lot of people don't recognize the residual impacts of the trauma they experience, right?
Right.
Can you identify how that showed up for you? I mean, you've accomplished a lot, right?
Yeah.
You are living a life that people literally dream of, like to be able to travel when. But when you look at the things that you have experienced, do you recognize spaces in which you were slowed down by what you had encountered?
Yeah, for sure. I would say one thing that I've worked on through therapy over the years is realizing that other people heal at a different rate. And my therapist and another psychologist told me as well, you have something called radical acceptance. So you can go through something extremely traumatic. You're able to cope with it, deal with it, heal from it at a faster speed than your average person. And you more so focus on the solution than the problem. Whereas a lot of people, you know, and rightfully so, take time to process what's happening to them. So for me, in friendships and relationships, when something bad happens, I think, okay, this is the problem. Here's how we fix it. Boom, boom, boom. That's it. And when someone doesn't move at the speed that I move at, I get very annoyed, or I think, oh, there's something wrong with you. Because it's in my mind, having been through all I've been through, I think that's such an, like, your problem's so insignificant, or it's such a small thing. You don't like your boss? Okay, quit. Like, I'm just saying, your boyfriend that treats you bad, they leave. Like, for me, it's so simple. And I realize that everybody has different life experiences and everybody heals from things differently. And you cannot expect people to move the way that you move. I would also say, in terms of relationships and dating, I've made a lot of excuses for men. And I have gravitated towards men who have grown up in similar situations, whether it's people who've had abusive parents, people who only have one parent, or because I've always felt that someone who came from a perfect household could not possibly understand the craziness of my life. And so I tend to select someone who I can relate more to in terms of our childhood. What I've learned through that is, you know, I've done the necessary work to heal myself and be able to build the life that I want. But typically, unfortunately, in our society, a lot of people haven't. And a lot of people are unaware that they need to. So I need to stop trauma bonding, essentially, and finding people that I could relate to from the negative things and start focusing on people that I could relate to with the positive things. The unfortunate thing about that is that's a smaller selection of people.
I laugh because I can relate. I can relate to both things that you just said. I experienced compounded trauma for decades. So now I'm in this space of I am healing. I'm on a healing journey. I don't believe that there is a place where we are healed. I think we are always healing. I'm on my healing journey. And now I'm like, why aren't you healing too? It's not that deep. Like, what you're talking about to me right now is not that deep. Like, what are you talking about? And I have to catch myself and be a little bit more empathetic, because I understand that not everybody is on the same level
that is my weakness.
Journey as me. And I can also recognize the trauma bonding. And I thought, you know, wow, at least I don't have to explain me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, God. Me. So it's an easier transition. But then I also found myself again in that narrative where I'm healing. I'm progressing and you're staying here, attached to the trauma, attached to the circumstance, attached to the identity of victimhood. And now I'm tethered to you because I trauma bonded with you, right? And that is what my relationships have looked like beyond the abuse that I endured. So I can definitely relate to you in that instance. And, you know, healing from periods of long-term survival mode, it's one of the things that I'm really passionate about talking about. And I have coined it in a way that it's three phases. The first step is self-awareness. The second phase is reprogramming. And the third phase is reinvention. And what I loved about what you said is the level of self-awareness that you have. And that's something that it's a tremendous gift to have self-awareness. Like, I liken it to a lighthouse on a dark night. The middle of the ocean, and all of a sudden you're in range of this lighthouse that gives you the ability to see in front of you, to the left and right, and to your rear. And it gives you the power to navigate the circumstances that you now are aware you're in. I think so many people are operating from a space of a lack of self-awareness. And one of the reasons why I'm doing this podcast is because I think so many people don't even realize that they're in survival mode. It becomes such a part of their identity that without the awareness, they never escape it. And to me, that is so tragic. And I, you know, I want to raise awareness so that people are able to make better choices and really take radical ownership of your life, their lives. And I, again, salute you for being 15 and knowing that this is not how I want things to progress. And I'm willing to do what needs to be done to make a change for me.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I was braver at 15 than I am at 30. I don't know. I think of that 15-year-old. I didn't give a damn about what anybody thought. I still don't, for the most part, but you're more conscious of certain things as an adult. You're more influenced, I think, because especially with my job, I interact with way more people than I did, you know, in a small town in South Carolina at the age of 15. But I just... it's more of a struggle as an adult because you have more mature relationships with people and friendships with people. And when you're a kid, you know, your friends are your friends almost by force because you live in a certain neighborhood, you go to a certain school, you don't really have many choices. This is what you got to work with for, you know, the amount of time you're in school. As an adult, you get to choose. But as an adult, people have also grown with their trauma. So, you know, you're not as affected, I don't think, as a kid because you're still figuring it out. When you're well aware of it as an adult, and when you have, you, I feel like when you have self-awareness, you're also more aware of other people and how they're maneuvering through their life and society as a whole. And it makes it a lot more difficult to have meaningful relationships with people, because I think you can be empathetic and understand that people are suffering from certain things and, you know, have work that they need to do within themselves. But it's a struggle for me with the balance, because I also don't want to constantly be in a situation with people where I'm having to coach myself, like, okay, like walk, almost like you're walking on eggshells. And to your point, I think there's a lot of people that are just unaware of just the small things. And not everybody's gone through something horrifically traumatic, but even small things can have an effect on your mental health. And you may think that, oh, I'm fine and I'm great and I got it all figured out. And yeah, every friendship I have doesn't last for more than a year. Or yeah, I can't keep a job. It might be some like micro trauma is what I call it. It might be something so small that has subconsciously impacted you that you're just completely unaware of it. And it's affecting your relationships, or even your relationship with yourself, your ability to achieve what you really want to achieve because you've talked yourself out of it, or you've let other people who mean nothing to you affect your ability to do what you really want to do with your life. And one thing I've learned, I traveled to 20 countries, I've lived in 7. The common denominator with everybody from every race, religion, and age, I have found that most people are not living the life they want to because they're doing what they were told to do. And I think,
yes,
a horrible way to live. And that, if anything, listen, I'm happy to die alone at this point. And one thing I can say, that if today was my last day on Earth, I would have no regrets and I would not be kicking and screaming, because I've lived the life I wanted to live. I created the life that I wanted to live for me. And I think a lot of people are going to leave this Earth not being able to say that. And I have such peace in that. I think it's such a gift and such a blessing to be able to say, you know, if today was my last day, that's okay, because I've done everything I wanted to do. At the age of 38, I've accomplished everything I ever wanted to accomplish. And I've lived the life that I want to live, and I don't really care what other people are doing. And that's my advice to people, is to really sit down. I do this every month. I make a list. I have a notebook. Every month I write down 3 things. What do you want? What do you love? And what makes you happy? And every month I must do something on from the 3 things that I write, and whatever it is I love, I have to do that thing once a month or once a week, whatever it is. If you have the time to do something for yourself once a week, you need to do something for yourself once a week. If there's a goal that you want to achieve, what are 5 things for that goal that you can do to get yourself closer to that goal? Doesn't mean you need to accomplish it this month or this year, but when you're reaching the end of your life and you look back at all the things you didn't do, the hundreds of millions of reasons you gave yourself not to do it, a lot of people leave with a lot of regret. And so I think it's worth trying rather than not trying at all.
Yeah. And I agree with that. And that's one of the things that I talk about with clients around the reinvention part of,
yeah,
of survival mode, is letting go of this societal expectations, right? We spend so much time conforming to the conveyor belt of success that has been sold to us.
Right.
And most of us get, you know, I think that's what a midlife crisis is. We get to this place and time and realize, wait a minute, be doing this, and now I'm gonna get the rare car that I want, and now I'm going to quit my job and travel the world. You know, I, as someone who traveled full-time for 2 years on the back of being faced with homelessness, and I made a decision, I'm not gonna be homeless, so I'm gonna take my kids and we are gonna slow travel through Europe, which lasted for 2 years. That was a conscious decision to like take ownership of my circumstances and make it so it works for me. And I really just encourage the listeners that, listen, you have so much more control over your life than you can ever imagine. And it comes 100%. Down to making that decision that you are going to live the life that works for you. It's not about your mama's expectations, your father's expectations, your cousins, or something. Someone said in a magazine that at 40, you should be doing this. Live your life. Live your life.
Take one
ownership of your life, because we only have one opportunity that we know of.
It's true.
But certain.
It's true. Yeah.
And it cannot be spent wasted being tethered to the residual impacts of big trauma, small trauma, micro trauma, because that's not what life's about.
Yeah.
Maria, I have really enjoyed this conversation.
Likewise.
I think it opens the floor up to a deeper discussion, you know, about how we are really navigating through life with the traumas, with the experiences. Are we taking control, or are we allowing ourselves to give into the patterns that no longer serve us? So listeners, thank you so much for catching this episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I want you to remember, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built just to survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you next week.